Lifeway Leadership Podcast Network.
You're listening to the newchurches.com Q&A podcast. New Churches is an online hub for the mission of church multiplication. Here you'll find the resources and training you need to get started, as well as a community of church planting and multi-site experts to help you thrive. My name is Daniel Im, and today's episode is going to be a little bit different. In fact, you probably looked at the time and you're like, whoa, how is a New Churches podcast episode so long? Well, it's because I am going to be just quickly introducing a conversation that we had with Brian Sanders on micro church planting. Now, you've probably heard of Brian Sanders if you've heard about micro churches or Tampa Underground, the guy, and we've interviewed him on newchurches.com as well. I mean, the guy is brilliant and is such a prophetic voice into the church. Well, a couple months ago, as many of you might know, a part of New Churches, we have a partnership with the Billy Graham Center and with the Sen Institute and Lifeway Research, where we put on a biannual event called CPLF, which is the Church Planting Leadership Fellowship. In other words, we basically convene about whoever is in charge of church planting for their denomination or their network in North America, and we have about 75% of all church planting that takes place in North America is represented by the leaders that we convene together. So a couple months ago, we had Brian Sanders address this group. So when you listen to this episode, yes, he's going to be talking about micro church planting, but just recognize that the audience to whom he was speaking to were individuals in a denominational or a network position where they are leading church planting. So there might be some things that he's addressing that you're like, oh, as a church planter or as a pastor, is he talking to me or is he talking to those who are from the denomination? And yeah, he is talking to them, but really, I thought that this episode was going to be an incredible, you might have read his book on microchurches or on the underground, but this episode is going to give you so much insight into the workings of what he is processing all about micro church planting. Now, if you're listening into this and you're like, wait a second, I'm a denominational leader or I'm a network leader and I don't know anything about CPLF, well, good thing. In November, we're actually going to have our next event. And because of COVID, it's going to be completely online. Just go to newchurches.com/CPLF to learn more and to apply to be a part of our membership. So it's going to be November 17, 18, and the entire focus is going to be on hard places and hard times. In light of what the church has morphed into, we're going to be looking at the ecclesiological implications of online church. Ed is going to kick us off very first session for that event. And then we're going to go into what are the impacts during COVID and what is church going to look like post COVID? And then we're going to be looking at hard, in a sense, every place has become a hard place because of this situation that we're in right now. So that is what is coming up November 17 and 18. So if you are a denominational or a network leader, be sure to go to newchurches.com/CPLF. Register if you haven't registered. And if you're not part of our membership, just apply there and I will see that application because I'm the one that looks through all of that. And I would love to have a further conversation with you on that. All right. So without further ado, here is the episode with Brian Sanders on micro church planting.
I want to introduce Brian Sanders. I think probably for most of you, he doesn't need an introduction. Brian has been the founder and executive director of Tampa Underground, the whole underground network. And I first met Brian about 5 years ago when Exponential and the Send Network were collaborating together to bring multiplying leaders, churches who were multiplying at a high rate together. And we had this one boardroom filled with kind of the who's who of people. That's where I first got to meet Ralph Moore in the flesh, and I got to meet Brian. And so Brian has been, you know, quietly approaching this whole church planning conversation much differently, I think, than most And he comes at this from a different perspective. He comes as a missionary in many ways. And so he now is coming out of Dublin, Ireland, where he currently lives. But he is way down the road in understanding how microchurches might be able to be a great part of our future as we begin to sort of rethink of what church planting looks like. So Brian's going to speak. We're going to have about an hour of time with Brian. He's going to speak about 40 minutes. We're going to do some questions in the midst or towards the end. So let me just first welcome Brian Sanders. Come on, Brian.
What's up, Jeff? It's been a long time, man.
It has been.
It's nice to see you and other faces as well. Some I know, most I probably don't, but thank you for the privilege, I suppose, to be here. So I don't know. I mean, I guess you guys sort of guide. It seems like Ed likes to interrupt. So maybe at some point he can just jump in or stop the flow and figure out if there's a key time for questions or if questions are emerging and we need to stop, just let me know. I was thinking maybe just before I came on, I was thinking about in most disciplines, there's some version of what's called the Goldilocks principle or the Goldilocks effect. You know the story, the three bears, whatever. And something like rare earth theory, for example, so we're talking about astrophysics, if the Earth is just a little bit close to the sun, life is impossible. If the Earth is just a little bit farther away from the sun, life is totally impossible. If there's just a little bit more carbon, life is totally impossible. It's very special in a sense that planet Earth is exactly where it is. That idea of the sort of perfect placement, it exists, an idea like that exists in statistics, it exists in early childhood development, psychology. And so I sometimes wonder what's the sort of Goldilocks principle for ecclesiology? You know, what is the perfect size church? Or what is the ideal size church? Particularly if you're concerned with like volume or you're concerned with planting or scaling or, you know, seeing the growth of not just churches becoming bigger, but more of them in the world. For some reason, you're convinced that that's a good thing. I know I am. But, you know, it's not a question we ask, but it is a question we should ask. You know, what is the ideal size? And I think as Americans, you know, living in Europe now, I it's maybe a little more pronounced, but I think as Americans, we do tend to kind of believe that bigger must be better. And I just think that's probably like an erroneous assumption. It's maybe not even something we challenge or consider. You know, surely a church of 100 is better than a church of 50. Surely a church of 200 is better than a church of 100. Surely a church of 500 is better than a church of 200. But is it? You know, but is it? That's the question. So for us, I think coming at the question of like, I don't know, what's the ideal size of the church, has something to do with the time in which we live. So like Ed already kind of alluded to that question of contextualization. And of course, context is not just place, but it's also era, right? Milieu. And I think maybe that's part of what he was alluding to or getting at, that we have to consider the moment in which we live, the time in which we live. And what's the best size church, you know, for that? And it depends. It depends on what your values are and it depends on what you're trying to multiply or replicate. I will make the argument that smaller might be better, and actually smaller, figuring out a way to empower, launch, start, whatever, loads of smaller churches is possibly a more efficient way to come at things. You know, church growth, that whole kind of time era in which we lived, the church growth movement really gave way to like a church planting boom, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, of which many of us were a part. And that conversation now, I think, is being refined not by tactics, so not a conversation about what's the best way to plant a church or strategy, like how to plant a church, but more of like a metaphysical question. What actually is the church? Or what actually, what makes up a church? You know, I think of like in business, we're talking about a minimal viable product. Or what we, the term we use is ecclesial minimum. What is if we reduce down the church to its smallest core elements? We'd have to admit, yeah, that's the church. That's a church. Now, that's not to say you don't want other things. You don't want a more sophisticated version, or you don't want it to grow into having many other parts. But all of us have some sort of ecclesial minimum. We all, if pressed, we would come up with a list of things where we would say, if these things are there, then okay, that's the church. And for me, that's a critical question to figuring out what we ought to plant and how we plant. And we haven't done it. I don't know that we've done enough work. We've just sort of said churches exist. That's a given. They exist. We want to see more of them. So let's go out and let's just make more of them. And we didn't ask the question, but what actually is the church fundamentally? And is this thing which we've inherited, this you know, cultural expression of the church, which actually comes from a previous era or previous time, is it what we need, you know, going forward? So obviously I'm proponent of smaller expressions of the church, and I think this age demands it. And so it then leads us to the question: okay, if you can accept some smaller version of the church, and whatever that is for you, it might be six things, it might be four things, for us it's three things: worship, communion, mission. The coalescing of those three things in a group of people, I would call that the church. You know, the submission to the Lordship of Jesus, really sharing of life with other believers, and somehow expanding the boundaries of the kingdom of God in the world, somehow in mission. That's when that's happening, wherever that's happening, that's a church. That's the church at work somehow. And so, you know, for me, that radical sort of narrowing or simplifying then leads us to a question of leadership. Okay, so then who can lead those things? Actually, lots more people could than maybe a clergy class or seminary educated or whatever. And again, I would never argue, and maybe we'll get into this later, but I wouldn't argue that there isn't a place for the clergy class. I don't want to see a disillusion of that. I actually think what needs to happen is that those of us that are in primary full-time ministry, we have to change what we do. We have to change the service we provide to the churches, actually, to move more into like an equipping role. So can it be everyday people, essentially, that lead these smaller expressions of the church? And can we see a lot more of them? Can they be more nimble, more agile? Can they be anywhere? You know, I was also just thinking today, you know, we used to, sometimes if we go to plant a church, we look for a school or something like that because you need a place to meet. And so it's just this artificial transactional thing where we don't actually have a relationship with the school. We go in and we just offer them some money and we meet there. And in some cases we're annoying to the school or they do it because it's worth money or whatever. And the possibility exists of actually planting things that become partners with something like a school or a pub or a park or a community center or literally anywhere that people gather. And if there's real relationship, real partnership that's forged out of the fire mission, then churches can begin to, if you have to think of it in terms of gathering, they can gather there as a part of that ecosystem, as like a principal part of, because the relationships have been forged to be there. So if we cross that ideological bridge, the church planning game totally changes. So even the question that was sort of put to me, okay, what's the micro church planting and what does a micro church planter do? For me, it's a little bit off because, in a sense, we won't be the ones that plant microchurches. We're talking about pushing down to the priesthood of all believers, the planting of churches, and the possibility of actually saying, okay, well, then what is our role in that? Those of us in full-time ministry or in oversight or supervision of people in ministry, what role do we play if we're going to give the planting of churches to the priesthood? To everyone, to every committed disciple could, in theory, plant a microchurch. They could plant a small expression of church, which could grow into something much bigger, much more comprehensive, certainly. It doesn't have to stay small, necessarily. But it changes the not just the semantics, but the basic terms of what it is we're trying to do. So I would argue that we're looking for people. So a couple of the questions that have been posed to me are about assessment, coaching, working with planters, that kind of thing. And so I'm essentially saying that we wouldn't be hiring and assessing and coaching church planters. We would be hiring and assessing and coaching missionaries. We'd be hiring and assessing and coaching people that are sent by us to establish an ecosystem of mission where microchurches can grow or can emerge out of it. And again, this I think this is a really fundamental. This is going from sort of like a sequential view of leadership, which is like I do, you know, I follow these steps and we get this outcome. Very, very Frederick Taylor sort of scientific management approach. You do these things, you get these outcomes, you know, algorithm every time. To something maybe possibly a little bit more about environmental. So what we're sending people to do is actually create ecosystems that are rich and verdant and full of abundance and blow our minds with the stuff that they start. But, you know, they will need some sort of parameters. Every garden needs a fence around it. You know, they would need some sort of parameters to understand that. I sometimes like to reference a futurist named Paul Sappho, who talks about this sort of transitioning in cultural economies. And, you know, he would have said, like, after World War II, you had what he calls a producer economy. You know, so to that generation and the church, actually, in that time, too, the key was overcoming scarcity. It's industrial manufacturing complex, you know, producer economy. The hero was the manufacturer. The hero is somebody that made something, you know, produced something, factorized something, whatever. He said that happened, actually, in America. We overcame scarcity, and we actually overproduced. And so that then sort of transitioned us into a new cultural economy, which he called the consumer economy. And that's what maybe a lot of, I would have cut my teeth in theological education and trying to understand ecclesiology in a time in which the church was trying to express itself in a consumer economy. So it was trying to answer the question, what do people want? And how do we provide what they want? You know, the hero of the consumer economy is the marketer, you know, the person that could sort of convince you want this thing, you know. And it was a questionable time for us to apply that to biblical Christianity, kingdom thinking. I actually think there's lots of beautiful things came out of it. We certainly learned a lot. I think there's a lot of fruit. Obviously, God used it, but there's also some complicity there, possibly with you know, empire or you know, I don't know. Maybe we over adjusted to make the idea of the gospel, the kingdom, church membership is something you just came to consume. You know?
Hey, Brian, let me interrupt you here for a minute. Yeah. This has been really powerful, and I can see the chatter here in a lot of our minds. I think a lot of us have been watching you. You've been pointing us to a different way. There's probably some in this group that aren't as familiar, and maybe for that sake, give us a picture of what a microchurch looks like. What does underground look like? If you're just going to describe it in a 3 or 4 minute picture to somebody, just describe it for us.
Okay. Well, let me just segue then, because Sappho would say actually the time, 2008, November 2008, he'll give a time when the consumer economy gives way to what he calls a creator economy. And the underground was born in 2007, virtually the same sort of cultural moment. By the way, Airbnb, Facebook goes public, Twitter is born, Uber. We're talking about like platform services, you know, which essentially are abundance concept, like, you know, ways that just everybody's got a phone, so everybody can be a sensor for traffic, figuring out what traffic patterns are. Like, it's all there, recognizing that it's all there. So the underground then, we thought the same thing. We just thought every committed disciple, every committed Christian has a call probably from God to engage in mission somewhere in the world. And we needed to push people to answer the question, where are you called to do that? And then if you have a simple version of the church, like worship, community, mission, then you say, all right, get a team together and go off and penetrate that niche, you know. And we'll create a system that was brought up earlier. We'll create a system to support that not to command and control it, not a hierarchy over it, but to serve it, essentially. So people do crazy stuff. They come up with incredible things because we are placed in unbelievably unique situations. And by the way, you know, Seth Godin's stuff about there is no mass market anymore. There, we can't think of our cities as just chopping them up in maybe even something like missional communities where you have one missional community for every 1,000 people or something. That's not how we work. That's not the social contract anymore. Now it's like skateboarders who like fondue or something like that. That's a group of people. And if you happen to be a skateboarder that likes fondue and My Little Pony, then you are just uniquely positioned to create a microchurch for skateboarders who like fondue and My Little Pony. And actually, nobody else is. It's incredible the uniqueness of it. So, you know, you because you're asking the question of mission and because you're asking the question of calling first, people are trying to confront something. They're trying to say, what is wrong in the world? They're trying to look for something that's wrong in the world. So, of course, you have microchurches that come out of, they're trying to deal with unbelief, or they're trying to deal with poverty, or they're trying to deal with homelessness, or they're trying to deal with sexual exploitation, or they're trying to deal with something more human, like single moms or people that have been through some kind of trauma. But usually because they themselves came out of that experience. And so they're uniquely equipped. You talk about context, and you know that's those people understand that context in a profound way. That they can navigate it perfectly. So we have seen, instead of saying, okay, this is exactly what a microchurch should be or do. So we would say these are the terms for character, for behavior, but not methodology. So I have no idea how to start a microchurch for skateboarders who like My Little Pony and fondue. No idea. But presumably the people that are into that would know how to do it. And everywhere I go, I see that possibility because I've had the privilege of being around a community where people just come up with crazy stuff. We had a group of people who for a long time were working with the homeless, and they would do these open mic things where homeless people have artistic talent or skills. So they would do these open mic nights where outdoors people could come and just get on the mic and do their talent, whatever it is. And they started realizing they had all these homeless people that had really interesting musical skills. So they, another microchurch emerged, which was like, let's create a recording studio record label for homeless musicians only. And you bring those people in, they experience the dignity of like doing their craft, they can get cleaned up, whatever, and then they can disciple them. But they're entering into a relationship based on that idea of like music and music recording. I would in a million years never have thought of doing that. But so you have everything from a house church, which I think we can all sort of conceive, to something like that. Those would just be, I mean, maybe some examples. But, you know, look, if that's what we're trying to plant, then the bottom line is that it won't be us. We can't do that. We can do a few. We could do one or two, or we could do, you know, some as we go. We certainly should be embodying it as network leaders or as, you know, servant leaders to the decentralized thing. But we then suddenly need a new set of skills. A new set of skills to plant that kind of community or to plant that kind of ecosystem. So like, I don't know, something like empathy has suddenly become a top quality that leaders need. Like there was a time when you could lead from your sort of ivory tower and be amazing and be in a smoke-filled room and have to be all full of mystique and interesting and nobody really knows what you're thinking. And that worked for a while. That worked in the consumer economy. It does not work in a creator economy. Because people no longer want to define their lives by what they consume, but they want to define their lives by what they can create. So they want to have their fingers in the creation process of what the church is meant to look like for them. So living out the church, especially if we're talking about the intersection of the community, the people of God, and mission, they have to be able to determine where that takes place. And some idea that we're going to have some hierarchy tell people in a creator economy, this is where you're meant to go work. And we're going to chop up the city, let's say in parishes, or we're going to chop up the city into little, and we're going to put you in these things. It's not going to work, in my opinion, because people need more autonomy. They need more agency in the stuff they do. So empathy is a key thing. That means transparency, principled vulnerability, coupled with like an iron will to hold on to orthodoxy. So it's like this, you know, all these paradoxes which are suddenly important to hold networks together. It means coaching is more important than preaching. It means service platforms are more important than programs. It means co-work incubators are more important than sanctuaries. I'm not saying those other things aren't important, but I'm saying they've been usurped by you know, if you only have this much square footage or this much space, you maybe don't need a sanctuary as much as you need something like a co-working space.
So you're doing a great job painting this picture for us, and you're creating an ecosystem for people to live out the priesthood believer, the mission that God has called them to be. And at the same time, you're putting around a fence. You're putting some kind of a fence around things to say, these are the ones we're working with, and there's things that are going to go out of that bounds. How do you alluded to a couple of things, but what does that picket fence look like for you guys?
I mean, for us, it's a series of values. So, you know, I would and have argued that kind of the seminal leadership idea of the last 30 or 40 years has always been vision. They told us the best way to lead is to have a strong vision, and you bring people on board with your vision. So, you know, that's a certain kind of leader that stands up front and says, come follow me. I have an idea. You know, I met with God. He told me something. He didn't tell you, come follow me. You know, come follow this. It's a seer. It's a very mystical idea to have a vision, you know. And they told us that was the key thing. And it was for a long time. That's how you had to lead. That was the key skill that you had to have. And I would say that is giving way to like value-based networks. So again, hierarchies need strong point leadership and clear vision. Networks don't. So what networks need is a set of values that become covenant for them, because networks are completely built on mutuality. So in other words, I can come and go from any network I'm a part of, and I'm just simply asking the question, am I helpful here and am I helped? And if I am, I'll stay in the network forever. And if I'm not, I'll just opt out. So nodes in the networks are equals. This is so, so important, because I still don't think we get it. I think even churches that are trying to adapt or trying to maybe sort of integrate some of these ideas, this abundance technology or whatever, they still don't quite get the idea that there has to be a reducing then of the top leadership sort of C-suite function. Like the executive function is now servants, not dictatorial, like direction giving. I don't mean to say it in a negative way, because I don't feel negative about that style of leadership. I just think it's becoming less and less meaningful or less and less useful as we go forward. So really what we're talking about is like a set of values. We have 18, it's something we call the manifesto, and we have a leadership covenant. So we're asking people to adhere, like, and by the way, the manifesto is not just doctrinal, it's aspirational. So it's saying we believe this about the poor, for example, or we believe this about contemplation, or we believe this about the whole world, or we believe this about humility. Therefore, we will live in this way.
That's great.
And it's like a tough document to agree to. I mean, you feel it. You're like, I want to be this person, but I'm not. And I know that. So it's an aspirational thing. It's a commitment to be a certain kind of person. And that's what holds us together. That's the glue that holds us together. And for us, like our governance around that then has to change. Because, for example, if someone violates that covenant or violates those values, they don't answer to the hierarchy. They don't answer to one person or one sort of people pointing hats or something. They answer to everyone. They answer to the whole collegial leadership community, because we all said we were going to, in fact, yearly, we have everyone sign it. Like all our leaders come in. It's a sort of a ceremony of kind of agreeing again to these values, to this covenant. So that's probably what holds them together.
Yeah. Really helpful picture. Thanks for that. That's good.
So should I just dive into some of these questions that you guys gave me? Like,
let me just
question
ask
about assessment, questions about training, question about funding.
Yeah, I think let me ask you, have you seen an existing church move into a micro church idea that was healthy and it worked well? Have you seen some examples or any examples of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's the problem is it's a look, new ideas, every organization, every human enterprise has like an immune system. So if you introduce a new idea into that immune system or into that system, it could be perceived, it will be perceived as a threat. Even if you have every single person on board, every single key leader, like, we love this, we're going to move towards it. And suddenly the system itself is kind of attacking.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, the way you do expenses or where people park or who gets to reserve rooms in the building. I mean, it's like suddenly the system itself is resisting because the new idea is a threat to the system. It actually is a threat to the existing system. So that where I've seen churches, traditional form churches, try to integrate these ideas, they always have that problem. There's always going to be some resistance to that. And actually in most cases, my suggestion would be to actually create a parallel ecosystem next to your church. You know, years ago, Lockheed Martin, I think, created the first Skunk Works, which that term has actually come to mean something in business parlance or whatever. But it was Lockheed Martin, and that's where they created the stealth bomber was built in the Skunk Works. And so Lockheed had this building on site that nobody could get in. Even the CEO did not have a key card to get in, except the people that worked there. And everything that went on there was a total secret, and they could do whatever they want, and they could break stuff, and nobody knew what they were working on. You know, Ed was talking about research or R&D, that kind of thing, to create some kind of a space with its own terms where it won't be seen as a threat, or it isn't necessarily trying to come after the existing system. So I think when churches do that, when they create some kind of parallel entity who says, look, we love what we're doing and we're going to keep doing it. We're not mad at it. We're not trying to kill it, you know, but we also want to do this other thing. So give it a different name, or they create a little ecosystem within their greater system. Sometimes I think that has real promise in real life, because those people are allowed to operate under different terms.
Gotcha.
And they can operate, they can use money differently. They don't have to, maybe they're not under the tyranny of certain metrics yet. And so that's one, maybe I don't know of a single church that's just pivoted completely.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And not lost everyone and just started over.
System, the operating system is so fundamentally different.
I mean, do you know anybody that's done that?
No, that's why I asked you.
Yeah, okay, well, there you go. Yeah, there you go.
That's good to know. So we're all familiar here with more traditional ideas of church starting. So we get this. So if you're thinking about, and certainly it's not a rocket science, so you understand those. When you're thinking about looking for a leader that could pull off a healthy expression of microchurch, how would you describe that, the character of that leader?
We're looking for like a microchurch leader or like a network leader, like somebody we would send to.
I'm sorry, yeah. The network, yeah. Of course, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important question. So like assessment, for example, I know probably a lot of you do like spend a good amount of time and energy to do like thorough and thoughtful assessments. But of course, the key then is, are you assessing for the right skills? Are you assessing for the right competencies? And actually, interestingly, are you assessing for the right kind of character? So I would argue some of that has changed. Not that these things weren't important before or nice to have, but you know, for example, I would say in terms of character formation, what you're looking for in assessment now is, for example, servanthood. Like Robert Greenleaf's stuff on servant leadership, where he would say, look, I'd rather have a servant that I teach to lead than a leader that I have to teach to serve. Like it's what he calls natural servants. And natural servants can learn leadership, but natural leaders struggle to really authentically integrate servanthood. You know what I mean? They'll do it as a tactic, you know what I mean? They'll learn servant-like behaviors, but for me, that and when we think about our network and the sister movements we have around the world, we're looking for like true servants, like natural servants, people that actually enjoy, deeply and profoundly enjoy seeing other people succeed and seeing other people promoted and seeing other people thrive. So it's like not just the death of ego, because we all have an ego, we need to care for it. It's not the devil to care about your own, but what gets your ego fired up? What makes you feel good about you? Is it that you're aggrandized or that other people are? You know, I think, what was it, 2 Corinthians 4 is, I mean, to me, I can't think of a more timely and important verse for church planters or network planters or whatever. For what we preach, he says, for what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ is Lord. I mean, just think about that for a second. So we're not going to promote ourselves. We're going to promote Jesus as Lord, because there's an implicit rivalry there. You know, if we're preaching ourselves and Jesus is an addition, we have a problem. So what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord and ourselves. So we're still here. We're still leaders. We got to do something. And ourselves as your servants for Christ's sake. Hmm. Every single line, every preposition is important in that verse. We don't preach ourselves. We preach Jesus as Lord. And when we talk about ourselves, the role we play in your lives, which is important and significant and profound, it's as your servants for Christ's sake. I think that's key. So the character of servanthood, also modesty. I'm looking for, I think we have to assess for people that are not, it's not that you can't be type A. It's not that you can't be a go-getter. But it's this idea of kind of like, I don't need to be at the front of the room. And actually, if you have a person that just cannot survive not being at the front of the room, they're just antsy or whatever. I just think that is the devil's bargain. That is a Faustian bargain. You're gonna lose in this climate. If what they're trying to do is promote something which is essentially built in the idea of empowerment and servanthood, they're going to struggle. But at the same time, they have to have nerve. You know what Ed Friedman calls nerve. And the problem in our time is a failure of nerve. It's not that the modesty that they carry, like, I don't need to be up front, but at the same time, I won't cave if you want to do something compromising. Or, you know, the kind of contrarian theologian Pete Rollins says that the job of a leader is to refuse to lead. And I think there's a lot of truth in that in this time. In other words, I say, look, I'm in charge. I'm the leader. And I say what we're going to do here. And what we do here is I'm not the leader. You cannot look to me. You have to look to Jesus. So those are the terms, like you said, the fence, the terms are, I'm not your leader. Jesus is your leader. I'm your servant. But I have the nerve to set those terms and to not let them be compromised somehow. That's key. And I just think heart, like authentic. And of course, that's something we're always looking for in people, but like empathetic people that love people, not just people that are good on a stage. So that would have been, you know, a little bit less important. You know, you could have seen like a really successful church planter because they were just excellent in front of a crowd, and that could draw people in, and that charisma and whatever. But maybe there was a little bit of dissonance between their life and their character and their actual heart for God. Maybe they got ahead of themselves a little bit in terms of character or whatever. And I think that's another thing we just can't give up on. Competencies, Jeff, that would be like coaching is a new core competency that you brought up. So it's not that preaching isn't important, but it's just, can you communicate one-to-one anymore? And coaching, like coaching based on inquiry and listening and not just telling people what to do, not seeing yourself as a mentor, but seeing yourself as someone that's trying to draw out the genius in the person across from you or Christ in them, seeing like it's there, it's in them. And that's what coaches know how to do. Collaboration, like the day of siloed leaders that just run their own thing and don't play with other Christians in their city or aren't willing to do anything else that has mutual benefit. I think those days are coming to an end too. So what are we looking for in an assessment? We're looking for somebody that can work with others outside of their circle, outside of their sphere, for mutual benefit, you know, for mutual joy, for kingdom. Like I know your heart and your kingdom theology is like, we got to see our city and see the kingdom coming. And that's what drives us. Not my particular brand or logo or church or whatever. I think management is a much more important. So for a long time, we bought into this idea that like leaders don't manage and managers don't lead or whatever. And actually, I think maybe the most profound kind of leaders we need going forward are people that are willing to manage systems. You know what I mean? They don't, you know, guys that just won't answer emails or won't show up on time to meetings because they're demagogues or whatever. They're so awesome that they don't have to operate within the system or whatever. That's got to go. I think it's already kind of, you know, And then like design skill. So not just design in some artistic way, but like, can you design systems? Can you actually look at a problem through design thinking and say, okay, how do we solve this problem by creating something better? So that's some examples maybe.
Yeah, no, that's, and you spoke of a lot of things that certainly wouldn't probably be the deal breakers in most assessments for most church planners. So Jossi Shackle, you're probably familiar with his MPART.org thing, and they're planning churches all over India, and character is the thing. It's the only thing. In fact, it's what they pass on a person or leave a person just on that basis. And so I'm a high believer in that. That's awesome. Let me give you some questions that have been coming in. I've been kind of working some of those, but here's one. I like the possibility of the vision to develop unique churches for unique demographics. But what about the beauty found in the diversity of the body of Christ when people who are different from one another come together? So speaking of more of a heterogeneous kind of.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, whatever your eschatology is, you know, we almost certainly have this dream of heterogeneous community, you know, and it's just a question of how do we pursue that. So I think it can be a false kind of pursuit of diversity and reconciliation. We say, let's just have a lot of people who are different in the same room, but the people who are running the show and deciding what happens and what is said and what words are chosen, decide what the metrics are, and decide really literally everything around the terms on which those people meet are one kind of people. And that's, I think we all, if you're awake right now in the time in which we live, that has not worked. So instead, my belief is that where your diversity comes, and again, this is subtle too, but we talk about multiplication, we talk about reproduction, and I'm not sure those are the best words, because multiplication and reproduction also implies the same thing, cellular, right? It's the same thing sort of dividing over and over again. And I think what we want is diversity. And where the diversity comes is in allowing people to reach the people that they're called to reach. So what we would say is, look, whoever you are, wherever you come from, we want to help you plant the church, be the church in that place. And what we find is an incredible diversity. So then when you try to create a community around that missionary community, that leadership community, you have an incredibly diverse group, and it's really beautiful. And when it works, they're not necessarily mad at each other, because they have total agency and autonomy in the expression of the church that they're a part of. And if you're just serving them, essentially the platform in which they're interacting with each other is like open source, then there can be real appreciation. So to me, it's just another way to, it is one attempt to missiologically be concerned about homogeneity, like go reach these people that are very specific, while also the greater picture of the church representing its diversity. And one way or the other, we have to figure out how to do both. So if you can think of a better way, then that's cool too. But it's not that it's one or the other. It is, we're trying both with a centralized and decentralized form. You're trying to create both.
Do you see, Brian, sometimes in one of your micro churches is attacking a social fault line that is just, you know, something that's dear to their heart. Do you see diversity in that common spirits?
Oh yeah. And I mean, sometimes controversy, and, you know, people will take different positions. Like we have micro church, let's take like the human sexuality issue. So you could say, like, how do you deal with homosexuality, for example? Like, how would you approach that as a missionary? How would you approach it? And guys, people approach it very differently. There's loads of different ways that you could approach that problem. And we have microchurches that approach that community they would hold, I would say, an orthodox view of sexuality, but they approach the missionary engagement in very different ways and can be critical of each other to some degree. So again, trying to hold that together, hold that diversity together can be tricky because, but we're not going to impose ourselves on their methodology, you know, just okay. hold them to, you know, orthodoxy.
Let me throw a question, since you're speaking to a lot of people here who lead denominations, lead networks, and many of them have decision-making authority to rethink a lot of things. So can or would you give some guidance, let's say the idea of skunk works. A denomination or network wants to build a skunk works outside of the system for developing a micro church strategy. What advice would you give a group like that?
Not to be too detailed or practical, but they need their own leadership. They need their own governance, their own terms. I mean, you can put the same board members on the other board, but create a separate board, you know, give them their own funding, figure out a way in which they can determine the terms on which they do a thing. And I would say also, it's something to do with the sort of tyranny of metrics. You know, if we say, look, the primary metric, maybe we're not admitting it, but actually the primary metric is how many people come on Sunday morning. And if that's the primary metric, then the Skunk Works is going to feel pressurized to produce that, right? To get people to come on Sundays. So they'll say, oh, that's great. Go work with the homeless or go work with single moms or whatever. That's awesome. We love that. We do. Sincerely, truly. But are those single moms going to start coming on Sunday? Are they going to start coming to church? Are they going to start giving? You know, because those are the metrics, right?
Right.
And I think you've got to liberate that Skunk Works from those tyrannical metrics, or they won't work. They won't work because they have to have room. They have to have space to kind of explore their context and go back to the kingdom idea. We've got to start thinking like kingdom people. So there's a really interesting, a really strange book by a guy called James Kars, who I think maybe was New York University emeritus, whatever. I think he was a professor of religion, but he wrote a book called Finite and Infinite Games, which Simon Sinek just kind of pilfered and turned into a more popular book called The Infinite Game, which is much easier to read, much easier to understand. But essentially, Kars's idea is this. Human beings play two kinds of games. The finite game, which is like sports. It has a winner and a loser. It has a beginning and an end. There's clarity on what it means to score and what it means to win. And you know who your competition is. And it's finite, beginning and clarity of rules, all that stuff. And we play those kind of games. And then he says we also play something called infinite games. And infinite games, the rules are very open. They're ambiguous. There is no real beginning and there is no real end. We're somehow a part of some big, long thing. They tend to be more principled. It's not really clear who your enemy is or who your competition is in an infinite game. Instead, the goal of the infinite game is to just keep playing, to just keep taking part. Sinek tells an interesting story of speaking at Microsoft. And like 70% of the talks when he was at a Microsoft conference, they mentioned Apple. They kept talking about how we can outmaneuver Apple, whatever. And then he went and spoke at an Apple conference. They didn't mention Microsoft once. But they kept bringing up things like, how are we going to educate kids? How are we going to get this technology in the hands of whatever? And his point was, Microsoft is playing a finite game. You know, how do we beat Apple? And Apple's playing an infinite game. How do we somehow contribute to society? Now, here's the thing. When we have gotten ourselves in trouble, when we have done church planting wrong, and when we've sort of, you know, hand face plant, is when we've treated church as a finite game. And we've thought about, the church is something, I want my church to have more people than them, or I want it to do better than that, or I'm looking at metrics about winning, and that siloed us. I think it's broken our spirit. I think it's put our leaders of those systems in jeopardy, like their souls in jeopardy, you know. And there is this sort of renaissance. You're a part of it, Jeff. Many of the people on this call are part of it. There is a renaissance of seeing the work of the church as an infinite game, which we did not start and we will not finish. And there's something incredibly joyful. In fact, Kars says this. I have this line here. He says, the joyfulness of infinite play, it's laughter, lies in learning to start something we cannot finish. Mm. So the church, if anybody should know that or should understand the infinite game, it's us. We get it. You know, we're part of some incredible legacy of the sanctification of the world, the renewal of all things. We get to be a part of that. Now, we may go through a rough patch or a desert time in the history of the church. You know, we may just be holding on for a while, or we may gain ground. But we didn't start the thing. We're not going to end the thing. And we've got to see ourselves as part of that. And even in our city, are we playing an infinite game? Or are we playing a finite game? And I think this is a major problem. You know, if we're going to start a Skunk Works, can we let them play an infinite game? So even if you're still trying to just get butts in the seats and get more money and, I don't know, build the ego of your key leaders or whatever, even if you're still playing that finite game, can these guys not? Can these guys just give their stuff away, like a sharing economy, and just want to see fires lit and seeds scattered? And, you know, it is a little frustrating. It is a little more difficult to chart, to measure. And I don't think we should give up on that. I still think we should try to measure. But it can be more frustrating that way. But the end result, I think, is that we're part of something that's more that's like great. The church.
That was really good. That was a great, great picture, I think, for us to grab onto. And thanks for that. I'm going to, maybe here's another question. I think we have time for one more. And sometimes to understand something, you contrast it to something you understand. And so I'm going to ask you to do that. There's a question here. How is microchurch not simply a missional community model with an open-handed ecclesiology, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I think it could be seen as that. You know, all my friends who are you know, into missional communities, we're basically, we're cousins. You know, we're all playing the infinite game together. But I would push them. For me, it's a little hierarchical. It's a little bit like we're going to plant something, the mothership, which then has all these little subsidiaries. So I would say in microchurch planning, the key is that we're not creating subsidiaries or franchises off of one brand. We're really creating an ecosystem, an environment where autonomous people with real agency to do what they want, to express and be the church. Look, I'd say one of my struggles with maybe, and it's not everybody, but sometimes missional communities and the connection to disciple making, which is obviously critical, but the connection to disciple making can be so formulaic, can be such an algorithm that everybody's got to sort of make disciples in the same way. That it's almost atheistic, Jeff. It's like, where is God in your system? Where is God in your approach? So I think, and I think it's a theological conviction, but it's also a kind of disruptive creative question, which is like, where in your system of disciple making is there a hole that only God can fill? That something has to happen that only God can do. And if it doesn't happen, the thing won't work. And if we create a system that's so sequential that it just doesn't need God, I mean, actually, we do it all. And then we have an end result, boom, we popped out disciples or whatever. That's as they would say here in Ireland, you need to go have a think about that, you know, because that's something's not quite right. And we can do that. I think we can plant churches, we can plant microchurches, we can do missional communities in a way that's very, very mechanical. And doesn't actually need God. So for us, I think the difference of saying this is a church and not just a missional community. Missional community feels like a subsidiary thing of some greater ministry, church, whatever. And what we're trying to do, the empowerment of saying, look, you're a church, which means you're an elder and you lead it, and the expectations of biblical leadership is all on you, and it's totally your thing to lead, and you need to answer to God and to the community you're a part of. But, you know, that sort of agency that's built into that, I think, produces creativity, but it also creates incredible diversity. So people won't all look the same. So, and it's possible that missional communities don't either, because they figure out some kind of, so in the end, it can end up looking very, very similar. And I'm as happy as anybody, if you want to call your things missional community, it's no problem. Who cares, honestly? But the reason why we want to sort of appropriate the word church and give it away to the priesthood of all believers so they can feel the depth of that. If I'm a missional community leader, then I'm sort of maybe implied there is I'm asking, okay, well, what am I meant to do? Give me my marching orders. Give me my instructions. But if I'm planting and leading a church, I feel somehow maybe like I need to ask God, what do I do? What do I do next? How do I step out? And people can advise me, they can serve me. But in the end, I'm the one planting a church in this place. And I think that subtle difference could be empowering to people.
It's great. And it really goes along with, I think, the spirit of everything you've said, that the missing MO perhaps in is the equipping part of what leaders are doing. And I think that's been the lost genius in the church for a long time, hasn't it? Yeah. Well, Brian, what are you doing right now? You're in Dublin. What are you doing?
What am I doing? Well, I'm working with a few people here who are doing some pretty beautiful, brave things, and maybe just trying to get around Europe, even though they don't really want you to be getting around Europe. So I'm clandestine, still sort of traveling. Americans, we don't follow the rules. We don't care. It's bad. I'm embarrassed, but there it is. You can take the America. Well, you can take the boy out of America, but you can't take the America out of the boy. Anyway, so we're trying to serve people in Europe who are trying maybe bravely to make some of these changes, and don't know how long I'll be here, but it's
are you finding this is just for me, are you finding that working with, you know, a far more pre-Christian world than America, that this idea has resonance more so than you see in North America?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think certainly in the South where I'm from, and I think, you know, one of our biggest problems is just we still have this sort of like mythology or this crutch of we'll always get, even if you do church really badly, you'll get a few people to come, and it just gives you the wrong impression that you're doing something okay. Whereas in Europe, if you don't figure the thing out, you're not going to get a single person. Like, I was just in Brussels. It's like, dude, If you don't figure out that culture, if you don't like Ed said, if you don't discern the times and figure out who are these people and what makes sense to them, where is their existential need, you're dead. You're done. You're not going to just get 50 people and feel okay about yourself because they're just going to transfer in or something, or get a decent band together and you'll get some sort of false sense of success. It's like, it's not going to happen. So that desperation is like gold for iteration, experimentation, for learning. I mean, I couldn't be in a better place because everyone sucks at church. So everybody's open to trying things. Everybody's open to experimentation, and they know it. So there's the humility to build in, like, this isn't going to work. Denominations here are charting their demise. You know, they're saying, if we go at this decline rate, we will cease to exist at this time.
Right.
In fact, I talked to a denominational executive, I won't say what country, who said that the purpose of their work as a denominational executive was the orderly management of decline. That their job was the orderly management of decline. In other words, for 50 years, they've been going down, and they're just going to cease to exist at some point. So let's do that in a sort of the best possible way we can. I mean, obviously, that can't be the dream of the church. So anyway, open to experimentation, which I love, and the humility to ask the right questions and to iterate and keep learning.
That's great. Brian, thank you so much for speaking back to North America from the other side of the pond. And
it's good to see you guys. Yeah.
Yeah, no, very, very helpful. I know all the men and women who have been listening to this have really enjoyed this. So thank you so much. I'm going to hand this over to Daniel, I think.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Brian, for your time. Guys, it's so good to see you all. We're, as you know, over these next 2 days, we're really going to be posing a lot of different models that are outside of the norm for assessment, training, coaching, for a lot of the systems that we've built. We're talking about the different platforms, different ways. And what I so appreciate about Brian is he's so down the way in that he's not just talking about a different model. He's created a platform to facilitate a lot of expressions in microchurch planning. I think that's what's so neat about what Brian has been innovating and creating an ecosystem for. So thank you, Brian, for your leadership, for not just talking about it, but leading and continuing to push things forward. I'd love to pray for you And then we'll kind of go out into breakout groups. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the apostolic and prophetic voice that you've given Brian. God, we just pray that you would keep him close to you, deeply sensitive to your spirit, to continue to moving things forward, to innovating things so that we can see a picture as to what organizational change might look like, so that we're not declining steadily or orderly, but rather so that we are innovating for your kingdom purposes. So we thank you, God. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.